gone for a couple of weeks in this class, so I appreciate those of you that stepped in and taught while I've been absent. And I actually been to four different states in the last 2 weeks. And some things happened during that trip that are really relevant to what we're teaching the class. So I do want to give you a report and show you how it's relevant to some of the passages that we're studying. Because one of the things I did back east was actually go to an Evangelical Theological Society meeting. And some dramatic things are taking place at those meetings. But one thing I want to do before I get into that is finish our little session on human origins and Psalm 139 so we can actually close the door on that and move on to Psalm 147 and 148. And it seems like every time we get started talking about the last section in this whole piece, junk DNA, things come up. So I'm going to start with this so we can get it finished. And whatever time is remaining, I'll devote to reporting on the events that took place back east in my four-state tour. And if I don't finish that, I'll come up and give you the rest next week. And I don't have to travel, at least not on a Sunday. I am getting on an airplane Wednesday, but I'll be back Friday, so we'll be able to make the Christmas party. But after that, no more travel until towards the end of January, so it's looking good. But some good things are happening as we're on the road, and also we're making plans at Reasons to Believe where our scholars won't have to travel quite as much as they do now. I'll tell you more about that in the weeks to come. But we've been looking at the whole subject of junk DNA and trying to wrap up our study on Psalm 139. Psalm 139 is the creation psalm that predominantly targets God creating human beings and God's purposes for creating human beings, and just how wonderfully and fearfully made each one of us are. We are the most complex of all of God's creation within this universe, the entire universe. In fact, this is what we're going to see as we look at Psalm 147 and 148. Everything that God creates in the universe, everything that God creates here on the earth, all the life that God creates here on the earth is created by God to serve human beings. And so we're the epitome of His creation in His universe. He's created angels in a different realm to be the epitome of that realm, but we're the epitome of the physical realm, the realm of the universe. And as we've been discussing these past several months now, actually, looking at the scientific record in terms of human origins and what we see in the Bible, this is kind of the last section we're wrapping up, the dialogue between evolutionists and creationists on the nature of human DNA. And just to give you a quick review on this, when you look at the human genome, we see that only 2% of it codes for the building of proteins. I mean, that's one of the primary functions of DNA, is to provide the blueprints. Just like you need blueprints to build a factory, likewise, the cell needs to provide blueprints to build the proteins that are critical for the function of the cell. But as you look at the human genome, we have the least percentage amongst all species of life in terms of how much of our genome actually codes for proteins. And so people decades ago, 40 years ago, concluded from an evolutionary perspective that 98% of our DNA is junk. It serves no purpose. And the thinking that went behind that is that since we human beings, from an evolutionary perspective, are the product of natural descent, common descent from previously existing species, with each successive step in the evolution, you're going to be having more and more junk passed on. And since we're the last step, and we're going to have the most junk of any genome. So that's how they explain the fact that we have the least amount of our genome devoted to coding for proteins. They said, well, it's just because we're the last along a long evolutionary line. In each step along the line, you get the propagation of junk, and so it's no wonder we have so much junk. But this all got overturned about 15, 18 years ago when a group of physicists, not biologists, but physicists, actually began to analyze the junk DNA of the human genome compared to the protein coding part of the DNA. And they were anticipating that they basically built a computer program that would analyze the language complexity of the two different kinds of the DNA, and they're expecting to see a far greater level of language complexity and information content in the 2% than in the 98%. And what they found instead was just the opposite, that the 98% had the greatest language complexity, the greatest information content. And so that led to the question, what does that 98% do? I mean, if it's got greater complexity than the 2%, it must be doing something. And this is when, for the first time, biochemists began to look at that 98% to see if indeed it serves functions beyond that of simply providing the blueprint for building proteins. And I mentioned 3 weeks ago that a scientist that we're recruiting to join our Reasons to Believe team, full-time scholar team, is a gal who just got her PhD at Caltech. She's now involved in postdoctoral research studies, but my wife and I had the opportunity of attending her PhD defense, and we're really pleased that Katie has done as well as she had. She actually was given a special award at Caltech as she was ranked amongst the top three Caltech graduating PhDs. And since she was invited to give a public lecture as being in that top three category. But what I remember her saying, in fact, this is a direct quote I have from her. This is her opening statement, her thesis defense. Quote, it is extremely challenging to explain the origin operation of complexity. It is far more difficult yet to explain the origin operation of the control systems that manage the complexity. And if I were to give you a bottom line on that 98%, it's basically controlling the complexity. So the 2% codes for the complexity, the 98% actually manages the operation of that 2%. Although what has happened in looking at the 98%, they're finding that a significant portion of that 98% actually does code for the building of proteins. It's just that, yeah, some of it actually does code. It's something that has been overlooked. I'll get into that in a minute. So yeah, only 2% of the human genome codes for proteins. And the question is the other 98% the accumulated junk from hundreds of millions of years of evolution? Or is the DNA serving purposes and functions beyond simply the coding for proteins? And there again is where Katie Galloway's thesis research is significant, namely that the cells that we see in all organisms are filled with molecules that regulate and govern those that do code for the proteins. And you know, in one respect, this isn't surprising. That we human beings have so much, quote, control systems built in. Of all the species of life that God has ever created, we take the longest to develop, and our development is by far the most complex. So, for example, we come out of our mother's womb with a brain that's only one-third the size of an adult brain. That little baby is not able to care for itself, and as you notice, even that brain that's one-third the size, it's very heavy compared to the rest of the body of that little baby. And so those of you who have had the privilege of holding your child shortly after birth, you know you've got to cradle the head because the head is just so incredibly heavy compared to the rest of the body. But you know, we are the one species of life that has such a huge growth of the brain as we continue to develop. And for all you men in the audience, it takes 24 years after you come out of your mother's womb before you're, quote, fully developed. And that's particularly true of the brain of a human. That's one thing. You got to watch about teenage male brains. They're not yet fully developed. Those of you who are parents are probably quite well aware of that. Women develop in 23 years. And in the case of women, it's some of the physical development that comes at the very end. So the development for the human female is not the same as it is for the human male. But in both cases, it's incredibly complicated and takes a long time. And because it takes so long and it's so complex, it's no wonder that so much of our DNA focuses on that development aspect. And so Katie was actually involved in a brand new research group at Caltech that's beginning to look at those control systems that regulate the operation of the complexity. And in the sense of these portions of the junk DNA. This is something that was coined starting about 12 years ago. They began to look at these different pieces of what it used to have been called junk and have come up with five different categories. One that they call pseudogenes, things that look like genes but don't behave exactly like the genes that code for proteins. Then you got what are called signs. These are acronyms. It's not just astronomers and physicists that love acronyms. Biologists and biochemists love acronyms as well. SINE stands for short interspersed nuclear elements. And then you've got what are called the lines, and you can figure that one out. Those are long interspersed nuclear elements.
We need control systems over these guys.
And then you've got what are called the endogenous retroviruses. And I think you can figure out what that is. Those are portions of the DNA that are embedded in the genome that look like they're viruses. And evolutionists, for example, have concluded that these were viruses that got incorporated into the DNA and just kind of ride along. They're just useless components. We'll see that they're not so useless. And then last of all, you've got what are called the LTRs, which are the long terminal repeats. Now, you can pick up our book, Who is Adam, where Fuzz Rana actually took over writing down what actual purposes have been discovered in these five different portions. But this is a rapidly advancing area of research. In fact, I just talked to Fuzz on Friday, and he says, Hugh, you won't believe what's been published in the literature just this week. Because, you know, I told you 3 weeks ago about Fuzz's analysis of what's been called the ENCODE Project, which was a multi-year research program by a whole team of biochemists that wound up concluding in their paper that rather than 98% of the human genome being junk, they said it's probably significantly less than 20%. So they've identified a significant purpose in about 80%. And what's happened just this past week is they're going after the other 20% and finding that, hey, it's getting a bigger and bigger percentage of the genome that actually finds junk. And what it's exciting to Fuzz is, you know, there's a biblical principle here. The more you look for the handiwork of God, the more evidence you'll find for the handiwork of God. And it says nowhere else has he seen this in his field of biochemistry than looking at the human genome. It's like the deeper we look into the genome, the more purpose and function we're finding for that genome. And literally this very week, new discoveries were announced where they said, and they were just basically looking at these five different portions and saying, well, it looks like we're finding a lot more purpose and a lot less junk than what we think. Because, yeah, the ENCODE Project said it could be as much as 20% junk. But just this week they're saying it can't be as big as 20% junk. It's got to be less than that. But, you know, that was a phenomenal announcement when they went from 2% to 80% purpose and function. So what exactly does each of these different kinds of, quote, junk DNA actually serve? And this is similar to research that was done in the human body. I mean, I'm old enough, and some of you are about my age here in this class, to realize that when we went to school, we were told that we're the product of evolution, and therefore our human body is filled with a lot of useless components that serve no real function. And, you know, you probably all heard the primary example, the appendix. The appendix is just a useless organ that's a holdover from a long process of evolution. Likewise, our tonsils and adenoids, and likewise, we have this crippled back function. We got this tailbone, and that's simply something that's from the fact that we were descended from a common ancestor with the monkeys. They still have a long tail. Our tail got shorter and shorter, but we still have a little piece of our monkey tail left over. Well, what's happened in those intervening 50 years is we now realize that we were not looking for purpose and function in the right places. You know, in terms of the appendix, we were assuming that if it did have some God-given purpose, that purpose would, lay in the area of digestion. And medical research has shown as much as 100 years ago that the appendix serves no function in digestion. But today we know it serves a function in the human immune response system. And so today they do not cut out your appendix if you've got abdominal surgery. When I was a kid, if you had abdominal surgery, they always took out your appendix as we got to get this useless thing out of here because after all, it could get infected and then we've got to have to operate on you again. Let's just get it out of you right away. They no longer do that. They realize that that appendix is a good thing that you have in your body and let's not get rid of it. It actually serves a function. And likewise, I think I told you this story in this class about a month ago. When I was in a public school in Canada, they had doctors that came to a school and signed all of the school kids up to get our tonsils and adenoids removed. My mother was a nurse, and she protested and said, "You're not taking the tonsils and adenoids out of my son." So I was the only kid in my class that didn't have that operation. But now we realize that it was a good thing my mother protested, because we now realize that just like the appendix, the tonsils and adenoids serve a function in the human immune response system. So today, medical research understands that the human body, as Psalm 139 declares, is fearfully and wonderfully made. And there's nothing in our human body that is a waste. You know, my sons were saying, "Well, Dad, how come our fingernails grow so fast?" It actually makes a problem when we're typing on a computer. I said, "Well, you know, when God first created Adam and Eve, they were doing different forms of labor than we do today. And, when you're out there farming and you're trying to build houses out of the raw materials that are out there, your fingernails take a beating. And you need those fingernails to protect your fingers. And so it was important that they grow at a certain rate. And God knew that when there came a time when we didn't need the fingernails and the toenails to grow as fast as they do, that we would have scissors. And so we could cut them. God actually anticipated that, once we became sufficiently advanced, where we no longer needed that rapid toenail and fingernail growth, we'd have the means to deal with it. Hey, you had a quick question. Go ahead.
Yeah, my appendix almost killed me.
I can understand that. I mean, that's still true today. If your appendix is infected and in danger of killing your whole body, they take it out. Well, for example, I don't have a prostate. But you know why they took it out? If they didn't, I would be dead today. So in order to save the rest of my body, they removed the prostate. So there comes a time when, you're not going to live forever. I mean, all of us are the product of decay. It tells us that in Romans 8. The entire universe is subject to the law of decay. And hey, those of you that are younger, just look at those of us that are older. You can see the evidence of decay right before your eyes.
I deny that.
But it's also true of our internal organs. So, in that sense, it's probably good that they took out your appendix. That's kind of how the medical research works this day. They leave it alone unless it's in danger of doing damage to the rest of your body. Then they'll take action to either, repair it or to take it out. So, yes. They do, and it also plays a factor in minimizing the impact of throat infections. So, yeah, the adenoids and the tonsils serve. And that's the other thing, too, we're discovering, is that I've been actually reading some literature on this, is that it's more than just a simple pathway for the human response system. What we're learning is that the appendix, for example, is able to deal with a foreign invasion in multiple ways, not just one way. And what you're pointing out is evidently that's true of the tonsils and adenoids as well. So that's another example where the more you look, the more function and purpose you'll see. And it's kind of like looking at this book. Each chapter in this book has multiple messages in it. Well, likewise, as you look at our body, we see that it has multiple purposes. So I won't go into that in any more detail. Yes, go ahead.
When I was 3 years old, I had something called tonsillitis, which is just like tonsils out. And 2 years ago, I had an infection. I went to a doctor and he said, "Your tonsils are infected." I said, "No, they're not." He said, "They grow back."
They grow back, yeah.
So is that generally true? Or
it can be. I mean, that's happened. See, I told the story about how my mother protested and made sure that my tonsils and adenoids weren't removed. She didn't get to protest in time from my sisters. So my two sisters don't have their tonsils and adenoids. One case, one sister's got them back. So I'm not sure it's... I mean, I don't know enough about this stuff. I mean, maybe you can talk to Richard here. You work for a hospital.
No.
So are you... He's shaking his head. He's not an expert either. But, but it'd be interesting to see what the stats are on that really are. But I frankly don't know. Okay, moving on. Because, yeah, I really do want to, you know, wrap up Psalm 139 here. Okay, we got the pseudogenes. And obviously that's a title that's been placed on this part of the DNA by those who take an evolutionary perspective. But what we're discovering as we study these pseudogenes is that they play a role of protecting the protein coding genes from breakdown and malfunction. So if you can think of it, the pseudogenes are the bodyguards for the genes. So the genes that do protein code are protected by surrounding pseudogenes. So just like I had to have a bodyguard when I was ministering in Kenya back in 1988. That guy didn't do any speaking or writing. I did, but he was there to make sure that I could do the speaking and the writing. So
quality control mechanism?
Yeah.
Quality
it,
assurance?
Well, it mainly ensures that the gene doesn't get damaged. So it's there to protect the gene from damage. Because after all, I mean, you know, being an engineer, if your blueprint has a few pieces that get changed, so for example, an I-beam is taken out, that could affect the entire structure of the building. You know, just one little tiny defect in the blueprint can have really damaging impact. So you might say, well, you know, okay, only one step of the blueprint is damaged, but that one step could be quite crucial.
Part of that, the replication process is involved, make sure things are replicated correctly. Is
okay.
That part of that?
Let me give you a quote, because I was talking to Fuzz about this, knowing I was going to talk to you about this. I'm not a biochemist, he is. He says, it's really interesting. He says, you know, these things that we put in Who is Adam, and this comes straight from Who is Adam. The pseudogenes protect the protein coding genes from breakdown or malfunction. He says, what we're discovering now is how they protect them from breakdown and malfunction. What we knew back in 2005 is that they do play a role, because if you actually remove that pseudogene, then things happen. But now we're actually doing research, not me, but biochemists are doing research, where they're actually discovering the means by which they do protect. So again, I can give the analogy of the appendix. You know, we realize, hey, when you take the appendix out of people, their immune response system is more compromised than people who have their appendix. So it's got to be serving some function. But today we know exactly how the appendix works to protect the human body from invasion. Whereas, you know, we just simply knew that it did. And so this is kind of where the field is advancing now. You know, we've had this understanding that it must play some role in protecting the protein coding genes. Now we're actually discovering exactly how it does that. And, you know, what Fuzz is predicting is that the next, say, 10 to 15 years, we're going to see significant advance in understanding exactly how this protection actually works. And, you know, he's expecting it to be considerably complex. In other words, we're going to find that different pseudogenes actually protect in different ways. Now, the other thing that this is not in our book, Who is Adam?, but there's been recent discoveries that a lot of things that we identified as pseudogenes, and you can tell by the term, it's something that's a fake gene. It looks like a gene, but it isn't. But what they're discovering is, hey, some of these things actually do code for proteins. And so they're now reclassifying some of the pseudogenes as real genes. It's just that they didn't see exactly how it would code for the gene. So not all pseudogenes are pseudogenes, and those that are pseudogenes play a role in protecting the genes. Well, what about the signs, the short interspersed nuclear elements? They protect the cell from stress and regulate the expression of protein-coding genes. And what they're noticing here is that those species of life that experience the greatest stress during their developmental years have the greatest quantity of these signs. And, of course, we're at the top of the pile. I mean, when you look at a young child that goes up through his growing years or her growing years, during that period, there's a lot of stress. It's a lot of physical stress, a lot of emotional and intellectual stress that's going on. And our DNA is designed to help us deal with that stress. And the stress is not always a bad thing. Stress is important for the growing up process. I mean, you can even see that in wildlife. You notice that the mother lions, for example, will purposely expose their cubs to stress because they understand that stress is important in the development. But likewise, we have these elements of the DNA that are designed to protect the individual cells from the stress. And what about the lines? These are the long interspersed nuclear elements, and some inactivate the X chromosome so as to prevent genetic disorders. So, after all, I mean, we have a shorter chromosome, we men, than the women, and it's important that some of the components of that X chromosome get inactivated at the appropriate times. Otherwise, you develop a genetic disorder. And the lines actually play a role in activating that. How did they discover that? Well, they discovered that by looking at genetic defects and genetic disorders. And what they discovered is that the lines were being damaged by mutations and therefore were not able to inactivate that portion of the X chromosome, and that generated the genetic defect. And others will turn off one of the two genes inherited from the organism's parents. So, I mean, you don't want both elements operating in certain cases, so it's important that one be turned off. In fact, a lot of what we used to call junk DNA basically are on-off switches, making sure things are turned on at the right time and turned off at the right time. So, for example, you don't want the growth of a growing boy to continue past the age of 24. You want a switch to turn that off. And we know what happens when that switch isn't turned off. You wind up with gigantism, where you get people that are eight feet tall or even taller than that, and they wind up dying from physical exhaustion. Yes?
Would Klinefelter syndrome fall into that?
Pardon me?
Klinefelter syndrome fall into that?
I don't even know what that is.
XXY?
So. Huh?
XXY 37 chromosome.
Okay, you're out of my area of expertise. But, you know, I'm gathering from that, that's an example of a genetic disorder that's generated by one of these signs not functioning. So, okay. Sounds like you've had a lot of experience in that. So, okay. So, thank God for, you know, this is something we could all be thanking God for at Thanksgiving, right? Thanking God for the signs and the lines and the LTRs and, you know, how they protect us from all these damaging effects. And then you got the endogenous retroviruses. And what we're noticing, yes, they look like viruses, but they look like viruses for very good reason. They're actually designed to protect ourselves from viral attack. I mean, we're surrounded by viruses. And these viruses can be serving a useful purpose. Some of them are designed to actually try to kill us. And so we need defense mechanisms in the cell to defend against the viral attacks. And we talk about something going viral, that means it's everywhere. Well, that's kind of a good adjective because that's what viruses are like. They're literally everywhere. Everywhere within your body, everywhere outside your body. I mean, we celebrated Thanksgiving. We thank God for all the viruses that play a role in increasing the rainfall so we could actually have the crops that would make possible for us to enjoy all the vegetables we got to eat at Thanksgiving.
How long are your Thanksgiving prayers?
Well, my sons are pretty aggressive at making sure they don't go on too long. But what often happens is we have discussion around the Thanksgiving table, and you tell us something really exotic we can thank God for. In fact, it was Wednesday just before Thanksgiving. I was back east and doing a radio show in Pittsburgh, and they gave me a whole hour to thank God for stuff that people don't normally thank God for. So you can imagine what I talked about. I said, well, since I was an astronomer, I started thanking God for the symmetrical spiral arms of our Milky Way galaxy. and for the size and shape of the exotic dark matter halo that surrounds our galaxy, and explain why we need to be thanking God for that, that if that wasn't set up just the right way, none of us could celebrate Thanksgiving. And we went on to thank God for the sulfate-reducing bacteria that have been here for 3 billion years. And yeah, we thank God for the viruses. So.
Were you invited back?
Actually, they've had me do this every Wednesday before Thanksgiving for the last several years. And what they love is the fact that every time they bring me on, I come up with a different set of things to thank God for. And it's like, you know, there's no end of things we can say. But it's kind of underlying the principle. A principle we're going to see in Psalm 147, 148. Everything that God creates in His universe is there to serve the needs of us human beings. And therefore, there's no part of the created realm that we can't be thanking God for at Thanksgiving. That's kind of how I wrapped up that one-hour interview. And, you know, just kind of as a humbling perspective to realize God did all this just for us. Therefore, we must be very valuable in God's sight. And we really need to take seriously why God put us here on planet Earth at this time and place. This is something I shared with you before we started Psalm 139. Because David makes the point that God chose the time of his birth and the place of his birth. And I believe that's true of each one of us. God has chosen the date and the time of your birth for a specific purpose. So each of us needs to think about, okay, why was I put here at this particular time and place? And of course, we don't stay where we were born. We move around. God made us mobile. You know, what is it that caused me to leave Canada and come to the U.S.? And what is the purpose that God had me start off in Canada and wind up in the U.S.? So all of us need to look at our entire lifespan and realize that God's been in control of everything that's happened. Because what does it say in one song, Psalm 139? God not only predetermined the date of our birth and the time of our birth, but He also predetermined everything that would happen during our lifespan up to the day of our death. And as King David said, you also have a purpose in the date of our death and the place of our death, and everything will happen in between. So in terms of looking forward to death, realize that God has a purpose in determining the day you will die and the place you'll die, the way you'll die, and everything that leads up to that. I mean, that in itself is something that we didn't talk about that at Thanksgiving, but maybe next Thanksgiving we'll talk about that. Yeah, go ahead.
It seems to me that these genes are the ones that really control it, so maybe you can say that that's God, you know? But the thing is that our whole bodies and everything around us is one battleground. I mean, look at these genes. They're fighting each other. They're viruses and germs and bacteria and all that. I think it's done by that. So our whole system is a one whole battleground. So it's just like the world, right? So to me, I mean, he could have done it a lot easier. I mean, we're too complex, in other words. Why these little tiny things?
That's exactly the question God wants you to ask. Why does He create these viruses that make us sick every year? I mean, how often do we get the common cold? I just took my flu shot. I mean, why are we in a world where we even need to take flu shots? And consider this. The angels don't get the cold. They're not being attacked by viruses and bacteria. So clearly God could have created us in such a way that we never have these kinds of attacks or the need for all this DNA. Notice how much of this DNA is there to defend us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's all there to protect the genes and make sure we don't get overwhelmed by the viruses.
He could have made us all angels.
He could have. But you know, He made us as human beings, distinct from the angels, because He's got a different purpose for us than He has for the angels. And part of that purpose is fulfilled by us being exposed to bacteria and viruses, being exposed to the second law of thermodynamics. You know, the angels don't have that experience. But what does Paul tell us in his epistles? We are blessed above the angels because we are exposed to these things. The angels watch the grace of God. We experience the grace of God. And in one sense, I look at these retroviruses, endogenous retroviruses, the grace of God. God gave us these things to defend us against the viruses. By the way, I got a misspelling there. That's not how virus is spelled. So But you had a comment. Go ahead.
Just one thing. What is a retrovirus?
Okay, a retrovirus is something that looks like a virus, but is designed predominantly to protect the cell from viral attacks. So as the viruses invade the cells, these things operate in such a way as to defend our DNA from attack. And, you know, that's the whole point is, you know, you want to protect those blueprints. And it's not easy to protect those blueprints. They're subject to the second law of thermodynamics. They're subject to these viral attacks. You've got to make sure that the genes are turned on at the right time and turned off at the right time. And therefore, we need this incredibly complex genome in order to provide that high level of protection and operation. Because after all, we're the species of life that actually gets to live 70, 80, or 90 years. I mean, for example, if you look at the bobcats that run around our neighborhood, 8 years is about it. I mean, if you bring them into your home, they can live for 20 years. But out there in the wild, it's about 8 years. Therefore, they don't need as complex of a genome. They're not going to live that long. But as I've mentioned here in the class, we're the one species that has about four times the level of activity in our lifespans of all other animals in the face of the earth. We get to experience about four times as many heartbeats. Turtles live longer than us, but they don't have as many heartbeats. They live, but they don't do much. We get to live a long time and do a lot during our lifespan. And so, but yeah, in response to your whole point, Al, is that God has a reason to put us in a realm where we're subject to these laws of physics, all this decay, and also a reason why he gave us the free will in such a way that evil can come into our midst. And he's actually using all this to serve a good purpose. Because he says, after all, you're being prepared for a career in the new creation. And that career is extremely challenging, and you need to be trained. And so, one sense, we can thank God for creating these viruses. It's all part of the training program. We can thank God for the evil. It's part of the training program. We can thank God for the fact that our internal organs don't always work the way they should. That's all part of the training program. And the merciful thing is we get trained in just 60, 70, 80 years. Some get trained in just 20 years. And none of us have to put up with it for more than 120 years. So, I mean, it's remarkable how rapidly God can prepare us for the incredible careers we'll enjoy in the new creation. And you made the point. The angels don't suffer all these things. But what does God say? You human beings who submit to my plan of redemption, I'm going to put you in charge of the angels. You'll be ruling over the angels. You'll be teaching them and managing them. Because you're trained, they're not.
Billy Graham was right. They're going to wait for on us when we're in heaven.
They will. Well, I mean, you've got the author of the book of Hebrews saying, even now, many of you have served angels unawares. Frequently, God will send his angels down to the earth to serve us human beings and preparing us for future careers. And often it's done in ways we simply can't detect. And so when things happen to you and you say, boy, you know, I should have been dead, or some miraculous event happened whereby you get to minister in a way that's completely unexpected, maybe an angel intervened in your behalf. Sometimes they intervene in visible ways. You know, people have told me stories where an individual shows up, assists them with something, and then suddenly disappears right before their eyes. Human beings don't do that. Angels do. And so they're there to assist us. But typically they assist us in ways that we don't see. That's why it says, many of you have entertained angels unawares. But there will come a time when we'll be placed over the angels. And so right now, we're lower than the angels. But there'll come a time, because of the training we're going through, where we'll actually be elevated above the angels. So that's why Paul says, take this life here on earth seriously. You're only here for a few decades. Run the race of life for all you're worth, because there's a prize at the end. And not every Christian gets the same prize. So those who run the race in a more diligent manner, in a more committed manner, will be given a greater role in the new creation. We'll all have different jobs in the new creation, but in some respects is dependent on how well we undergo the training right now. Kind of like someone you go to college. know, the student friend of yours who wound up getting straight A's all the way through college will probably be able to get a superior career than you who got a C average all the way through. So, of course, these days they give A's to everybody, so I don't know. Yeah, go ahead.
About the word retroviruses, isn't that what they call the virus that gives AIDS, Marburg, Ebola? Aren't they called retroviruses?
Some of them are.
So is that the same use of the word as you were discussing in?
Well, as I mentioned, these were terms that were produced by people who take an evolutionary perspective on how our DNA came about, not by God's hand, but by a long period of a common descent. So these are their terms. It's kind of like Big Bang cosmology. I don't like the term Big Bang to describe how our universe was created, but hey, it's the term that's in common use. We have to go with it. So kind of like, you know, we talked about the People's Republic of a democracy in the days of the communists. Well, it wasn't the People's Republic and it wasn't democratic, but it was the term that they used. So, moving on, the LTRs. Some protect the organism from retroviral attacks, so it's not just the endogenous retroviruses that do that. Some of the long-term repeats play a role in protecting organism from these attacks. And as you mentioned, some of them are called viruses, some of them are called retroviruses. And because viruses are so complex and so differentiated, we need complex and differentiated DNA to deal with those attacks. And others regulate the expression of certain protein coding genes. But one thing Fuzz has been sharing with me, in all these five categories, we're finding that some of them actually do multiple purposes. They protect, but they also play a role in coding for certain molecules. Okay, let me try to wrap this up because I'm now down to just 20 minutes and take you through these DNA tests for the Garden of Eden hypothesis. And this is, again, a very fluid area of research. Mainly what we're recognizing is that the dates we're deriving from these DNA tests aren't as reliable as what we thought they were. But mitochondrial DNA. Now, mitochondrial DNA is DNA that exists outside the nucleus of the cell. And all of us get our mitochondrial DNA from our mothers, but from our mothers only. So your father does not contribute to your mitochondrial DNA. But this is useful for doing genetic analysis of the past history of humanity because we know, for example, that the only way my mitochondrial DNA can be different from my mother's is if I suffer some kind of mutation. And so what people are doing is looking at mitochondrial DNA across the human family, both present and in the past, by digging up dead bodies and analyzing their mitochondrial DNA to try to measure the mutation rate, the natural mutation rate in the mitochondrial DNA, and see if they can trace some kind of ancestry. And when they do that, they discover that we're descended from one or a few females. And if you read the scientific literature, what you'll see is that the data is consistent with all of us being descended from one woman. But it's also consistent with all of us being descended from several women. So, for example, when we debate theistic evolutionists, they'll make the point that maybe the number could be as high as 1,200. Of course, that number has been shrinking as we learn more and more. I remember when the number was as high as a million, then it dropped down to 100,000. If you look at Francis Collins' book, The Language of God, he says 10,000, now they're saying 1,200. It seems to be heading in the biblical direction of just one individual. Nevertheless, when we debate the theistic evolutions, they do concede a point. The data is consistent with us being descended from one woman, but it also could be consistent with us being descended from several women. But that explains why you see in the scientific literature the reference to the mitochondrial DNA Eve, making reference to the fact that the data actually is consistent with all of us being descended from one woman. And if they look at the data, what you'll often see in the scientific literature is that they found a location for the mitochondrial DNA Eve to either be in South Africa or East Central Africa, you know, places like Ethiopia, all the way down to the eastern part of South Africa. But if you actually look at the data, you discover that the error bars are much larger than that. And so that's why I put down here, it's consistent with Eve coming somewhere near the juncture of Africa, Asia, and Europe. The scientific literature often says, Central Eastern Africa, but the fact is the error bar on that is about plus or minus 3,000 miles. And so, well, that's something that, Fuzz and I are recognizing and looking at the science, is that often these people never quote error bars. And therefore, they'll get these results as if they're hard and firm and fast. In fact, when we've been dialoguing with theistic evolutionists, that's one thing we've noticed, is that they read the scientific literature as if there's no error on the result at all. And in fact, there is significant error. And also, when you look at the scientific literature, they'll say that this first woman lived 150,000 years ago. That's typically what you see in the documentaries. I've now seen scientific papers that put it as far back as 250,000 years. And this is all based on the recognition that this is difficult work to do to try to date this. And I'll explain why it's so difficult to date in a minute. Well, in fact, we did. Remember we did that little discussion where they did some experiments with sheep on Haute Island in the Kerguelen Archipelago, and they wound up coming with far greater differentiation in the mitochondrial DNA than what their models predicted. Well, it also means that the dates that we're going to get are going to be way off. And so this explains why you see such a broad range of dates. But one of the things I point out here is that if you look at this room of people here, most of us have just one set of mitochondrial DNA from our mothers. But 10% of us in this room have two sets. And probably one of you in this room has three sets. And when you take into account that heteroplasmy, people with two sets, triplasmy, people with three sets, what that does is divide the dates by about a factor of three or four. And that's why I'm saying that it's actually consistent with that first woman living roughly 50,000 years ago. But now there's a recognition based on the fact that these theoretical models of descent based on DNA are not matching the experimental data, that really the dates are not that accurate at all. In fact, Fuzz and I are now of the opinion that DNA is really useless for getting a date for humanity other than something that's very, very approximate. And rather, we're much better off getting dates from what we call the cultural big bangs. That when human beings come upon the scene, you see an immediate use of clothing and technology and jewelry and advanced tool use. And those are dates that are consistent with humanity showing up about 50,000 years ago. Whereas here we're getting dates that could be easily off by a factor of two, if not three times. But one of the things we do notice in looking at human mitochondrial DNA is that the degree of change or mutation in the mitochondrial DNA is not very large. And this is something we also discern in looking at Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA, is that the DNA changes very slowly. And given how slowly it does change through mutations, we recognize that Neanderthals in humans, for example, cannot be the product of common descent. In fact, we can't be the product of common descent with any bipedal primate that we can identify in the fossil record. The DNA simply doesn't change rapidly enough to support an evolutionary paradigm. So the fact that we see insignificant change in the mitochondrial DNA argues for special creation and against common descent. Fuzz is going to be incorporating this in a new book he's writing with a tentative title, Common Descent or Common Design. And I'm making the point that we have evidence that it can't be common descent, but it could be common design, where God will design, say, the internal organs of the great apes in a similar fashion that he designs the human internal organs, because after all, they have the same, serve the identical function. And they're roughly the same size, so we shouldn't be surprised that we see a common design, something we see in the automobile industry. When they come up with an optimal chassis design, they repeat it in many different models. Just because, hey, this is the best possible design, then why use something inferior? Let's just copy it over and over again. Why chromosome? This is something that only men get. And so we men have a Y chromosome. The women do not. But that means that the only way my Y chromosome can be different from my father's is if I suffer some kind of mutation in my Y chromosome. And so again, they use a differentiation of Y chromosomes for human beings to see whether or not we're descended from one man, and a rough date for that one man. And so we discovered that it's just like the mitochondrial DNA. It's certainly consistent with all of us being descended from one man. So this is why they refer to this Y chromosome original human as the Y chromosome Adam. So it is interesting in the scientific literature they're using biblical terminology. And this all happened because of these DNA studies showing that the DNA gives a story that's consistent with what the Bible has taught for thousands of years. Likewise, we see that it's consistent with the Bible story about the Garden of Eden. Incidentally, theologians debate the location of the Garden of Eden. I just came back from the Evangelical Theological Society meeting, and I noticed that there's quite a disparity of debate amongst theologians as to where the Garden of Eden is. You know, I've got my favorite location based on analysis of Genesis 2. It's a place where four main rivers come together. But I've also run into theologians who think that the Garden of Eden may have been somewhere around Lake Victoria.
On what basis?
Well, the Nile, they claim, may have been the Pishon or the Gihon, and maybe there are other rivers with names. So, I mean, I'm not saying they don't have any case at all. So I've got my favorite interpretation. I think it's consistent with the most literal reading of the text. But the whole point is, just like geneticists will debate the location of the first man and the first woman, likewise theologians are debating the location of the Garden of Eden. And in both cases, the range of location is about the same, about plus or minus 3,000 miles. This is consistent. Live near the juncture of Africa, Asia, and Europe. To me, what's encouraging about all this, it looks like the first man lived at the same place as the first woman. So, looks like they didn't have to go around looking for one another. Now, incidentally, there's a little more in the data than what I'm suggesting. Indeed, the error bars are large, but the error bars are about the same in both cases in terms of the systematics and the random errors. So what is fairly secure is that the first man, the first woman, did live in the same location, plus or minus about 500 miles. However, based on the systematics, where that location is can vary by a few thousand miles. And I will take your question. I've been ignoring your hand.
Last one, though.
Okay.
Just on your statement that men and women had to evolve at the same time. If a man evolved first and there was no woman, died out.
Right.
No evidence.
Right.
Same with the woman. There'd be no evidence.
Yeah.
So the only evidence you get is when they evolve together.
Well, this is an argument for special creation. Because, you know, if the first man shows up at a different place than the first woman, nothing happens. And likewise, if they show up at a different time, nothing happens. So you got to have that woman and that man at the same place. Now, the date we get for the Y chromosome Adam shows up a lot more recently than the date we get for the mitochondrial DNA Eve. So this is what's called the younger Adam paradox. And looks like there is a time difference between the first man and the first woman. However, if you take into account triplasmy and heteroplasmy, they do come in at about the same time. So heteroplasmy and triplasmy would put the first man at living at the same time as the first woman. However, if you drill down into the data, there really does seem to be a difference in the dates, and we'll get into that in a minute. But we note, just like with the mitochondrial DNA, we can't see much change over time. Now, where this data becomes particularly secure is when they dig up a human being that's been dead for 25,000 years and measure the Y chromosome in that dead human being and compare it with modern-day Y chromosome DNA. And what they notice is very little change over that 25,000 years. Same thing with the mitochondrial DNA. So the very fact that there has... Looks like my battery went dark here. I think you can all still hear me.
Can you fix that?
All right. I think you can still hear me.
Oops, the battery just dropped.
There we go. We're going to, oh, hey, how about that?
Hey, Dave.
Hey, Dave. Boy, that's a lot faster than what happens when I'm on TV. I mean, they literally have to shut everything down. And so it is. Well, you know, Dave's actually done some TV work, and Dave, that's a whole lot faster than what's happened when batteries died for me when I've been doing a TV production. So, okay, Younger Adam paradox. And this is where you look at stable kits. You say, what are stable kits? These are population groups where they don't marry outside the kit. You know, I'm a Highland Scot, and so no self-respecting Highland Scot's going to marry a Campbell. So that's one of the things. We just don't marry the Campbells. And the Campbells have nothing to do with us. And it's because, well, I won't go into the history of all that, but the whole point is there are kits, for example, Jews typically marry Jews. They don't marry outside their kit. Likewise, Armenians tend to marry Armenians. And then Estonians will marry only Estonians. And Finns will marry Finns. Japanese are very stable. And so I've been to Japan five times, actually. And what I notice is that the Japanese kind of look at themselves as superior to all other human beings. And for that reason, they really don't want to marry outside of their racial group. And so, but what that means is you actually have a very stable population situation. And because for literally thousands of years, they've not crossed those ethnic boundaries, it means that this is the best population in which to try to get into the ancestry of that group. And when they do that, they consistently see that you get the, you know, taking into account triplasmy and heteroplasmy, you still see the first man living coming about significantly later than the first woman. Now, that's the opposite of what the Bible teaches, right? The Bible teaches Adam comes first and Eve comes second. What we're seeing in the DNA data is that Eve comes first and Adam comes second. So this is the paradox. But it's a paradox even for those who don't believe in God, because how can the first woman live thousands of years before the first man?
She waited around long.
Well, that might be an argument for the first human beings living a long time. But notice what the Bible says. Even the first humans only lived a maximum of about 900 years. And so the data is showing us something that's significantly longer than just 900 years. How can this be? And if you're saying that this is consistent with the Bible, how can you resolve the fact that the Bible puts Adam first? This data seems to put Eve first. What's going on here? Well, here's what's going on. It's the story of Noah and the flood. And I'll take questions because I need to get through this before the time goes on, because I really do want to move on to Psalm 147. Okay. The Y DNA, according to the Bible story, is going to stop at Noah, not at Adam. Because the four men on board the ark are all going to have the same Y chromosome. Because you've got the three sons of Noah and Noah. The three sons get their Y chromosome from the one man, Noah. So if you were to take Y chromosome samples in the population today and trace it back in time, according to the Bible, it's going to bottleneck at Noah, not at Adam. And in the case of Eve, it could go back much earlier than the wives. Because what you have on board the ark are three sons of one man, but the four wives are not blood related. And since the four wives are not blood related, the mitochondrial DNA could easily go back thousands of years earlier than the women on board the ark. So it's the story of Noah and the flood that uniquely resolves the paradox of the distinction between the mitochondrial DNA and the Y chromosome DNA. So what is secure is that the DNA analysis tells us that there actually is a time difference. Now, what is not secure is how long that time difference is. We're saying thousands of years. That's what's in the published literature. But that data, I would not consider to be very accurate. It's thousands plus or minus. 3, 4, 4, 5.
guess the battery's gone out of me again. It means I probably should stop talking, right? All right, okay. Let me conclude with this verse. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. That's what Psalm 139 concludes. And the whole point of Psalm 139, of all the life that God has made, we are the most fearfully and wonderfully made of all forms of life. We're the epitome of God's creation here on earth. Well, I should get one of these. All right, this sounds good. This will help me in closing for prayer. But the whole point is Psalm 139 makes the case that we are the ones that are most wonderfully made and designed and created by God. The DNA evidence is showing that to be true. And hey, if you want to learn more about this, you can pick up our book, Who is Adam? And incidentally, Fuzz and I are in the midst of writing an addendum to that book. We were going to bring out a new edition to the book to take advantage of all the new discoveries that have been made, but we decided that everything in the book is fine as is. There's really no need to make a revision of what we stated in the book, but we're going to make an addendum that updates you with all the new material. But it's posing a problem. Our addendum is already at 100 pages. So, and that's hardly an addendum. And we're not sure what to do with that. The editors want us to shorten it down, but we're kind of reluctant to shorten it down. A lot of it is just set citations to the literature. But anyway, you can be in prayer for us as we try to figure out what to do to update the book. But in one sense, it's a testimony of just how rapidly the field is advancing. And as the field rapidly advances, it's rapidly advancing in favor of the biblical story on human origins. So it's a dramatic example right before our eyes of how the Bible's been vindicated through research in God's second book, the Book of Nature. Let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you that you saw fit to give us two books, the Book of Scripture and the Book of Nature. And we thank you, Lord, for the privilege of being alive in the early part of the 21st century, when our knowledge and understanding of the book of nature is literally exploding. We thank you for that knowledge explosion, Lord, and how it's showing your handiwork to a degree that we've never seen before. And Father, as that handiwork continues to be revealed, I pray that we would respond in a humble spirit and recognize how great and wonderful you are, the degree to which you've intervened, the degree to which you have bestowed resources and shown your favor upon each one of us individual human beings. We thank you, Lord, that the entire universe and all of its life and every single star that's out there serves a purpose in meeting our needs and helping us to fulfill our earthbound function and prepare us for life in the new creation. Lord, in humility, may we consider our responsibility to serve and please you, not as we see fit, but as you see fit. Help us to appreciate, Lord, the timing of our birth, the placement of our birth, what has happened in these intervening years since our birth, and what we are moving forward to in terms of our departure from this planet and moving on into the new creation. Lord, we thank you that as we study these creation texts and as we move into Psalm 147, 148, we will see more and more clearly the strong link between what your books teach about creation and what they teach about redemption. Father, I pray that as we explore what you've done in creation to prepare everything on our behalf, that we'll see that there's a second purpose in pointing a way and a path of redemption from the evil around us. And Father, I pray that you grant each one of us the humility to perceive the redemptive offer and to receive that redemptive offer. Lord, that we may be delivered from this entrapment of sin and evil around us, and through your Holy Spirit, step by step, be delivered from the power of sin, from the power of evil over our lives, that we may follow you and love you and follow and love one another for the rest of our lives in the new creation. In Jesus' name, amen.